The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist.
You're listening to Radio Aryan.
Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. And today we're going to deal with someone by request who was a great popularizer of both the Russian Orthodox Nationalist and Royalist ideal. And as is the case in the 19th and the 20th century, Royalists and Nationalists, with the exception of those in Austria, have a tendency to be similar, if not identical. We're talking about Lev Tikhomirov, who dies in 1903, who was a member of the most radical revolutionary organization, the so-called People's Will. The People's Will were the terrorist group that murdered Tsar Alexander II. And he went into exile in 1882 and repented. And so very much like Dostoevsky, who was a leftist as a youth, was exiled to Siberia for his activities and converts to the Orthodox Church and nationalism while in exile. And Tikhomirov is the same way. Keep in mind that the People's Will is the most violent of all of the pre-Bolshevik organizations and has the most radical and Bolshevik-style ideals in its organization. And in 1888, Tikhomirov publicly repented of his membership in that organization and wrote to Tsar Alexander III, repenting of his views, and he was pardoned. He wrote a book called Russia Political and Social in 1892, and I'm going to be drawing from volume 2 of that book. And Tikhomirov is an excellent writer and an excellent a political theorist who, in most respects, mirrors my own views. He divides Russians among the northern, sort of Novgorod, northwestern Russians, who he views as very strong and independent, the Siberian Russians, who are a little bit more primitive, but they are very strong and independent-minded. The Belarusians are highly energetic and intellectual. They are not really given to political resistance. They're very good-natured people. The great or central Russian so-called Muscovites have based their culture around the constant war against injustice and fragmentation. They are quick to forgive, emotional, and very gentle in character. I mean, they view the criminal as not someone to be destroyed, but someone to be pitied. And finally, the Ukrainians, of whom he has a lot to say, he views them as sort of the Russian southerners, the southern climate, very sentimental, romantic, more individualist and less communal, lovers of equality and democracy in the best sense. So he divides up the Russian people into these different groups, and in general sees that every group of the Russian family, subgroup of the Russian family, has its own particular virtue and its own particular vices. The question of the Jews is something that Tikhomirov concerned himself with because he was a member of the People's Will, and the radical left terrorist organizations were top-heavy with Jews. The Jewish mentality, in his mind, was very strong. He does believe that the Jews, essentially the overwhelming majority of Jews in the empire, are Khazars, that they dominate the merchant life, and that they hate the peasantry. They hate the peasantry wherever they go, and they hate the work on the land. And the only reason that they would have anything to do with the landed life and the agrarian life is to be able to profit from its ownership and leasing. Now, Tikhomirov says the following. Jews are not inherently an evil people. They are no more evil or good than any other group of people in the world. But he believes that Jews have become a perverted people because of their own clergy, of their own upper-level oligarchs. That this small group of Jews dominates the great mass of the Jewish nation. And he says, in his experience traveling the country, most Jews are poor. But the wealthy Jews and the rabbis use this constant threat of the savage goyim that just can't wait to kill them all as a way to control the poor and middle class Jews. They rule them with money, and they rule the poor and middle class Jews with an iron fist no more than they rule any other people that they come in contact with. But he views this as a perversion of the Jewish mind, which he, in and of itself, does not see as evil. But like a lot of groups of people in the world, this notion of this singular cultural nationalism is based on the interests of the upper classes that use this ridiculous threat of anti-Semitism to consolidate their power over others. And so if there are no anti-Jewish things happening, they have to invent them. And he does believe in some form of Zionism where the Jews should be sent to the Middle East, where then they could develop their life independently. They will no longer be exploiters because they will have their own state and society, and they will then work on the land like any other people because it is in fact, at least in their minds, their land. And so at least in one way or another, and maybe I shouldn't even say the Middle East, is really just the concept of them having their own state and their own society that they run by themselves and for themselves, and there they will not be exploiters and they will become like everybody else. They will work the land and have a normal life. And it's only because of their dispersion and this oligarchy that rules them that they have become this perverted people. But in and of themselves, they are not an evil people. There is nothing special about them that sets them apart from anybody else, except this rabbinic and upper class desire to use and exploit lower class and middle class Jews. But his big issue was that of the autocracy, the monarchy, and those things that, those institutions that support it. In early medieval Russia, the trade on the Dnieper River led to the emergence of a middle class, a merchant bourgeoisie, that slowly but surely found itself destroyed with the rise both of the Tartar attacks and the Muscovite domination. And this bourgeois idea was destroyed early on by the Moscow princes, who eventually developed a centralized landed society rather than a trading society. That had been the case in the Ukrainian or Kievan Rus period. But this is not a moral problem, but as I have argued many times, it's really a matter of Russian vulnerability and the fact that it can be attacked from any side and really has no natural boundaries, that unity and strength required a tightly centralized, landed, rather than a trading society. Moscow became the center of operations against its many enemies. And so unity and loyalty, because of Russia's position, became the primary virtue. So the unification of Moscow and unification of all Russia into the empire was about destroying the old upper classes and replacing it with what we call the service class, or those people who held land and power based exclusively on their loyalty to Moscow. But that is a result of Russian vulnerability and is simply a natural and rational reaction to their exposed position. Now, the monarchy is a popular institution, and Tikhomirov is one of these people that holds that in any kind of democratic election, the people, the peasantry especially, will always vote for a monarchy or someone like a monarch. But historically, Tikhomirov's position is that the monarchy became popular and the common population, not the upper classes, but the common population, really loved the development of the Muscovite Tsar because this grand prince was capable of fighting off and controlling the landlords that oppressed them. And so he makes the argument, and many others have done before him, that Tsarism and the centralized bureaucracy of the Muscovite state came into existence, at least largely in part, because of the popular will. Tsarism was a despotism in his mind, but an absolutely necessary one. But the result of this is that the destruction of the old aristocracy meant that civil society, in the normal sense of the term, was stunted compared with elsewhere. But again, this is not anything special about the Russian mind. This is the nature of Russian circumstances. And so his position is very much that of Montesquieu, where a climate and the nature of the natural boundaries or lack thereof is all important in how political institutions and political ideas develop. There's nothing innate with people that have them develop certain ideas. It is their surroundings. Russian nobles came into existence because they were men of service. The Tsar is dependent on this class, and the result is that this class held land because of its loyalty to Moscow. And so loyalty was given in exchange for serfs. And so property was simply the concept of what you get when you serve the Muscovite state and what you get when you contribute to its solidity, stability, and defense against outsiders. And so this aristocratic class was a military and bureaucratic class and never became, like in Great Britain, a powerful economic force. The Tsar was despotic in the sense that he didn't have to answer to anyone save God and canon law, but the Moscow Tsars never developed the resource base to oppress anybody. They simply didn't have this capability. And Tikhomidov and many others really hold that what we today call totalitarianism can only develop in a society that has the economic resources and the technology to extend the rule of the center over every place. If the society is based on military power and religion, this does not create the social economic base necessary to create despotism. The Russian Tsar was despotic in the sense that he was unlimited, at least in practice, not in theory, but not despotic in the sense that he was not totalitarian. There was simply the resources simply were not present to make this a reality. The peasants loved the Tsar, but they hated the nobles, and this is a central popular issue in the Russian tradition as it developed. And so he argues that the development of the Russian aristocracy in the Muscovite period, Ivan III, Basil III, Ivan IV, the development of the aristocracy, the military service class, is based not so much on ability, but on loyalty. And so the royal government continued to reward this class and created more and more levers of power for the nobility to use over the population. And like a lot of monarchists in the 19th century, he was opposed to serfdom. He understands, and I argue this in the Third Rome and elsewhere, that serfdom weakened Russia. The nobles, because of this relatively unique situation, never developed any kind of civic mission. The concept was loyalty to the Tsar, the bureaucratic activity, and the exploitation of serfs, which was his payment, since these people were never paid in cash. But it separated the Tsar from the common people, and that serfdom weakened the Russian people. And it's often the case in these more traditionalist royalist thinkers that they view serfdom as a great evil. It comes into existence because of the necessity to maintain a disciplined laboring class in a terrible climate with poor soil and short growing seasons. And that this is why it never developed in Ukraine. And this has been a thesis of mine and many others for a long time. But again, you can't impute this to the Russian mind, so to speak. This is simply a rational response to the admittedly very, very difficult circumstances of the Muscovite period in Russia. He views, like a lot of people, the emancipation of serfs in 1861 as an absolute disaster, that the peasants did not receive the land that they required. They received less than they actually had under serfdom. The peasants had to pay for it in the sense that the noble class was compensated by the state for any land that was brought into the orbit of the commune. But the nobles squandered this money. They did not invest it where they were supposed to. They invested it in this constant drive to be Europeanized and to imitate the life of the Western noble class. So within a generation after the emancipation, both peasants and nobles were deeply in debt. And the result is that the nobles did not invest their money in industry. And so ultimately the development of capitalism in Tsarist Russia was in the hands of foreigners, Jews and the Old Believers in particular. But the development of the local so-called county assembly, the zemstva, did help at least a portion of the noble class develop some kind of civic virtue. He held that the so-called zemstva liberals were not really of the noble class. They were essentially a middle-class people who eventually created the backbone of the liberal movement in late Imperial Russia. But he does hold that the zemstva system, which was part of the reforms of Alexander II, did create some sense of civic mission in that minority of nobles who were able to take advantage of it. So the point is that Russia developed differently because a bourgeois class never was capable of developing. Only a tiny percentage of the old noble class ever went into industry, and the result is that industry ended up in the hands of foreigners, or alternatively, the state. And the merchant class is really the only winner. The merchant class in the towns, which were organized into guilds by the state, really took their profit in an exploitative way from both the nobles and peasants. But he also says that by 1890, the capitalists were the only productive part of the Russian Empire. And the most capital was either through foreigners at high interest or from the state. So even in that regard, the development of capitalism did not develop in a normal way. So for a royalist, he is critical about what has developed since 1861. He doesn't see the emancipation as a success. Most people did not see it as a success. He also thought that the lack of a middle class in Russian life was debilitating. But all of this and all of these problems forced upon Russia are made up for by the commune. For Tikhomirov, the commune is the ultimate Russian institution. It defines Russian social philosophy, and it defines the mentality of the great Muscovite Russians, given their geographic and climatological circumstances. Tikhomirov interprets the development of the commune in the Muscovite period of Russian history, similarly to the way that he describes the development of the centralized Muscovite state. He sees the average peasant squeezed between the extraction of the Mongols on the one side and the exploitation of the Western Europeans, especially the Germans in the Baltic, on the other side. And so the commune was a means whereby the peasants could protect themselves against predatory merchants and capitalists. The development of the commune created a local democracy that then freed the central government from having to worry about democratic rule, since the most significant part of the peasant's life was local. In fact, maybe the only part of a peasant's life was local, and his rule and his laws were popularly voted on through the commune. The traditional Russian village is very small and intimate, but the Miet develops as an institution of necessity. Unity, integration, a demand for equality, and almost an orthodox protest against the merchant mentality of Western Europe. It is, as he would put it, an orthodox Christian socialism, which is the national idea of the great Russian people. He doesn't believe that the average serf was oppressed in the sense that a slave was oppressed. I also made this argument in the Third Rome and elsewhere. The serfs had judicial rights. They had property rights. The owners, by law and statute, did not have the power of life and death over their serfs. And the commune did protect the rights and equalize the obligations of serfs even during the period of serfdom prior to 1861. Peasants did believe that the land belonged to them collectively and that the institution of serfdom was a necessary transitory institution needed to protect the Russian army and income and economic health against its many enemies. But serfdom, on the other hand, did dehumanize the peasant. It turned him into a beast of burden, but on the other side of that, it forced peasants to cooperate and to work together to minimize their lot and their oppression under the noble classes. That ultimately, the great virtue, in the Russian peasant, in Tikhomirov's opinion, is that suffering for the group, for the commune, for the mir, this is the greatest of virtues. And sometimes these communes may take in more than one village, especially if the village is small, and then they develop a certain specialization. Certain types of agriculture, like sugar beets or rye, certain kinds of production. It could be iconography, or it could be artisan work, or it could be light industry, textiles, etc. And so he sees, far more than most other writers on this topic, a certain economic rationality to the commune. It functioned as an individual in civil society. And so the concept of an Orthodox Christian socialism is not something in opposition to economic rationality and the desire for a just and legitimate profit for labor. The Russian village was uniform, and they stressed the idea of social conformity for the sake of self-protection, for the sake of production. And he views, the Ukrainians as being a more diverse people and slightly more individualistic. Now, he talks about another institution that doesn't get spoken of very much in the literature. It's the osmak. It's a social cell of rural security, as he calls it. These are voluntary labor groups that developed in Great Russia, developed in the later Muscovite period, maybe of 3 to 4 men that were able to work as a unit to make extra money for the village, for the family, for the commune. Now, the osmak does not get spoken of very much. And in many ways, you could see it as the individual, so to speak, within the village structure and within the communal structure. And even these small groups, 3, 4, 5 men, could also specialize within the commune or the village in a certain area of labor. Okay, I want to continue on the commune and Tikhomirov's political theory of the relation of the commune to the monarchy when we return. So hang in there.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We are talking about the Russian monarchy in the political thought of Lev Tikhomirov. And he spends an awful lot of time talking about the significance of the commune as the ultimate expression of the great Russian idea. The commune is the ultimate in this kind of Rousseauian democracy. the only real sovereign at the local level was the assembly as it is meeting. The village mayor is chosen and elected by the meetings of the commune or of the mir, but he only has administrative authority. He is simply an executive. Legislation and power comes from the commune itself. And he stresses the fact that women are involved in the assembly, that if anything, women are usually overrepresented at the village level because the men were usually off working. He also notices that the commune meets quite frequently. So the peasantry develops a strong sense of civic understanding that often does not get dealt with at any length in the literature on this subject. That these meetings were loud, these debates were harsh, and peasants in general had very strong opinions and were very politicized. And so, you know, think of them as some inert mass is an error. And the commune is a cell of local democracy in the best kind of Rousseauian sense that you can imagine, far beyond anything that had developed in the West. And so opposition and factions were everywhere in the communal system. But the only thing that really could carry the day in debate was to be able to convince others that the common good will be served and that justice within the common good will be served. So the concept of the individual was simply nowhere to be found. The main job of the commune was to divide the land and to equalize the holdings of each osmak or each family, alternatively, within the commune itself. The land was divided three ways relative to quality: poor, medium, and excellent quality land. And the nature of the equality was not so much in the amount, but its qualitative attributes. Each osmak gets a equal share of each type of land. And contrary to popular belief, you were compensated for any improvements that you make on the land when it's given to you. So there is an incentive to improve. The fields were divided by the number of osmaki that were in any particular village, any particular commune. And they worked at harvest time, they worked in teams, and they took shifts. So the work could be 24 hours a day. And the result of this was extremely efficient, and the entire harvest took about 1.5 days. On the other hand, it was about 13 years between each division of the land between the families or the osmaki, as it the small labor groups. The peasants, in his understanding of how the village, or I should say the communal debates go, they have a very powerful sense of the moral economy. The idea wasn't so much this practical idea of self-protection, but what had developed was a strongly sophisticated idea of social justice. Tikhon Medov stresses over and over again in his experience in different parts of Russia how central political theory was to the average peasant. The old canard of the peasants as these ignorant people, the so-called naive monarchist thesis that's so common amongst Americans, is simply false. Tikhon Medov proves through folk songs and his transcripts of communal debates that the common peasant was highly politicized and very much an idealist, and they expressed the so-called moral economy thesis very strongly. That the clan or zadruga system did exist in primitive Russia, and there was an early sense of a clan, an extended family, but the state will eventually destroy that. And the commune was partially a response to the decay of the clan system. But the main issue is that a commune, when it gets too large, will split. The notion is that democracy only works with small groups of people who know each other. And that's the only way that a communal law can be considered legitimate. He sees cooperation as initially a matter of practicality. It really comes into its own, in his opinion, under Ivan III. but the existence of poor land, the growth of population, forced cooperation. Cooperation came into existence and then developed into an ideal because of the poor land of northern and central Russia. The commune existed in part to protect its weaker members, the elderly, the sick, the orphans. All of these were wards of the commune. So ultimately what occurs prior to the Muscovite period is that the old Zadruga system, or the extended family system, becomes a extended commune, not the extended family, for those specific reasons. And he holds that the big difference in social development between Russia and Ukraine is that the extended family as the economic unit exists in Ukraine and in the Balkans and places like Serbia, but in Great Russia, the specialized cooperation, development of the Osmaki and everything else was necessary because of Russian vulnerability and poor soil. However, he's absolutely convinced that the commune precedes serfdom. The serfdom was able to make use of the commune. The commune continued to function under serfdom, and that mitigated its effects, but it does predate it. And it predates serfdom because it was absolutely an economic necessity given the nature of central and northern Russian land types. And the autocracy, he argues, consistently was faithful to the commune, supported the communal idea, and he saw it as a check against the increasing power of the service nobility at any given time. And he also was opposed to the idea of proletarianization. What can happen when there's too many landless peasants, the revolutionary situation that could occur, and that, you know, having landless peasants meant you had men that were difficult to keep track of, difficult to draft into the army, difficult to extract taxes from. Therefore, a strong communal system where everybody is looked after, where everyone had the minimum, where everyone was able to work and earn a living, was in the state's interest. Because there you could keep track of them. There you could tax them. There you can draft them. So the development of the commune and a more or less prosperous peasantry was in the interests of the state relative to those specific aspects of Russian development in the Muscovite era. So he concludes ultimately by saying that you can analyze the domestic policy of the monarchy by this constant going back and forth between the two entities, sometimes favoring the service nobility, sometimes favoring the commune. And these were checks on each other. On the one hand, the service noble was given power and land, but the noble always had to sacrifice his life, his money, his private life to service for the state. Now, it's true that the peasant was unfree, but that was a formality. The reality was that you really can't talk about the peasantry, and you can't talk about peasants as individuals. And this is a terrible error of some of the really awful Anglo-American historical works on the Russian peasant. You can only talk about either the village, or the commune, or the Osmak. You cannot talk about peasants as such. You can talk about these institutions. And Tsarist policy, depending on circumstances, went back and forth as a way to check local power, the landlords and the nobility on the one hand, and the commune and the village authorities on the other. Peasants equate the idea of politics with the commune. But the Tsar, for them, is not a political figure. He is a theological and religious figure. He is, so to speak, the symbol of God's authority over the earth. Politics, freedom, debate, virtue, these are well developed in the Russian peasantry. But they're well developed only in those areas that they can actually have authority and can change things. And that, of course, is the local level. So I'm willing to argue, and I've argued this before, and Tikhomidov argues this, that Russia at her best, is far more democratic than anything that developed in Western Europe or in North America, because voting for a president means nothing. Your vote is lost in a sea of votes. You have no power over what occurs in your state capital or Washington, D.C., heaven knows, and in other countries. But the one area where you can have actual power over your locality, that's the one area that has minimal power in the development of the Western industrial state and the scientific revolution. So the whole notion of this human rights and democracy in the West is phony. Because the only place that real democracy developed in the local Rousseauian sense was in Russia under the Tsar. And the stronger the Tsar, the more absolute his mentality, the more he came to support the commune. The more he came to support the commune as a manifestation of populism and a true Christian socialism over the often arrogant and domineering world, whether it be of the landlord or of the merchant. He views Russia's worst problem, as he's writing in the 1890s, as the lack of a respect for life. And this develops because of the rejection of individualism at all levels. They respected those in terms of the clergy. He's not particularly happy with the lower level married priests. Peasants respected those priests who worked, who tilled the land. There were some who were on a state salary. The priests who tilled the land were one of them, were one of the peasants. Him they respected. But those who were taking, you know, the typical state, you know, in the state church, priests were often on a state salary, at least in the modern era, in the Russian development of the Russian monarchy. They did not respect him. Tikhomidov is relatively critical of the clergy. In the post-Petrine era, he sees the clergy as simply captive of the state. Peter the Great destroyed the organic relationship between the Tsar and the people on the one hand, and the clergy and the people on the other. And he destroyed it by banning all forms of parish and monastic democracy, banning the democracy that occurred between the people and the bishop. All of this was part of the old believer idea and part of the medieval Russian idea, but in the modern Enlightenment post-Petrine, the empire, the imperial idea, this democracy was revoked. And one of the many errors of the Masonic Peter the Great, who in my opinion was not a legitimate czar, partially because of his Masonic membership and his dabbling in the occult. But clergy, really, in his mind, are, after Peter, agents of the state power. There used to be this democratic relationship between priests and people, and then the priests and people and the bishop. But now the bishop is imposed from above rather than elected and rules as a dictator. Now, the clergy, the married clergy, have little influence. The monks, however, had great influence, but the clergy as such he viewed as so close to the state that they had lost the respect of the common people. So they went to the monks for everything. And because of the old believer schism, losing that huge percentage of your most pious Orthodox people, it gave the state this excuse and the ability to dominate what was left over. And the old believers maintained this old concept of subordinates, this concept of Rousseauian democracy and the general will within the church, the presence of the Holy Spirit communicated by the ascetics and the saints. That's the concept here. That's the nature of Christian democracy. It is based on asceticism. And the old believers are taking the number of converts that they're taking largely because the church was in such a bad state at the local level. The relationships between the bishop and the czar were very poor. According to Gregory Fries's research, the bishops really in the Russian Empire were not canonical because they were largely chosen by the czar. And then they were shifted from diocese to diocese on average once every 7 years. which of course is completely non-canonical. So their legitimacy was hanging by a thread, and the result is that the old believers who maintained the true canonical life mentality of old Russia were gaining converts in huge numbers. They also were very, very successful economically. They were more literate. And according to many travelers' journals that I've come across over the decades, they were very clean, very tidy, very pleasant, just completely different from the typical Russian villager. And that the old believers maintained the best of Russian spirituality. And so the problem is that when they separated from the Imperial Church in 1666-67, the state was then able to impose itself over what remained because their best and brightest had largely left. So when the Ukrainian church developed later on, they took this older concept of subordinost and subornopravna and made it the center of their church reform. In many ways, the development of the Ukrainian autocephalous idea, which I have spoken of at length and in detail on this show, is in many ways a reform movement rejecting the imperial domination of the church in Great Russia and all that that implied in terms of the complete domination of the state over the choosing and moving of bishops from place to place, the domination over the monasteries and the destruction of many hundreds of monasteries over the decades, and the removal of the priest from the democratic vote of the commune. So the old belief and other groups were growing in strength because the imperial church, which did have its virtues, it did produce saints. I'm not saying that these people were just totally useless, but they did not represent, in the Petrine and post-Petrine era, they did not represent the best of the Russian tradition. The best of the Russian tradition was to be found in the old believers. Now, and so far as Ukraine is concerned, Tikhomidov kind of has my view and the view that was developed earlier by Gogol, that if you're going to be a nationalist, you have to be consistent. You can't claim that my people alone may be nationalistic and develop their lives on that line, but people around us are not permitted. And this has always been the case with nationalist movements and is one of the weakest aspects of nationalism as a basic political and moral doctrine. If you're going to be a nationalist, you must be consistent. It is intellectually fraudulent and dishonest to say that I, an Englishman, I believe in an integral nationalist England, but we have the right to dominate whoever we want. They don't have a right to this national independence. So in order to be a true English nationalist, you must also accept the idea of Irish and Scottish independence and their own territorial integrity. Now, of course, that could lead to a cooperative confederation of three independent states, and it probably should. But you cannot be a nationalist on the one hand and an imperialist on the other. They are opposites. It's like being a Roman Catholic orangeman. It makes no sense. Tikhomidov believes this point of view, and if he is to be a Russian nationalist, which he is, he also therefore must respect the Ukrainian nationalist movement, which makes the exact same arguments that the Russian nationalists will make, except on their own territory and for their own purposes. He views Taras Shevchenko as a great genius and a great writer, as he's writing in the 1890s. He does believe that most Ukrainians are probably pro-Russian, but he also believes that the majority of Ukrainians want some kind of localized, purely Ukrainian administration. So it's sort of like the relationship between St. Petersburg and Finland. Finland was a part of the Russian Empire, but was almost completely independent. Empires are not nation states. They don't require a unified administration. They require tribute to be paid by the subject nations. They are not any less national as a result of that. So he thinks that Ukraine should remain part of the empire, but should have a Ukrainian church and a Ukrainian national administration that is basically independent, but maintains its loyalty to the Russian Empire and exists in equal brotherly relations to the Russian Empire as a different people. In his view, that's probably the majority of the Ukrainian people. That is not to be anti-Russian, because being pro-Ukrainian is not to be anti-Russian. That's not how it works. That's not how nationalism works as a moral idea. As a moral idea, it is about cultural solidarity and law deriving from local custom and tradition, as it has developed through the sufferings of a particular ethnic group. So he sees the Ukrainian nationalist movement as ultimately an economic movement. He sees it as being anti-landlord, more distributivist in its economic point of view, that nationalism develops in Ukraine from these economic demands. These demands, which, by the way, are not illegitimate. He says that the Russian government in St. Petersburg has handled the Ukrainian issue horribly, and that whatever Ukrainian nationalism exists, it has been created by the ham-handed way that St. Petersburg has dealt with autonomous demands of the Ukrainian people. But the Ukrainian nationalist movement is economic and cultural. It's not really political. It wants a local administration, and it wants Ukrainian money kept in Ukraine, not being shipped off to the Russian state. That's the main claim of the Ukrainian nationalist movement, is its economic exploitation. That Russia needs to share its economic development with Ukraine. Of course, I've gone further than this and have said that Russian economic development is largely Ukrainian, and the constant extraction of natural resources and labor from Ukraine into Great Russia. His view is that if this national separatism continues to grow, and he's writing in the early 1890s, that this could only be good for Russia. The idea is simply this. If you had an independent Ukraine, it wouldn't make any difference, economically speaking, because Kiev and St. Petersburg would develop a confederation of sorts, that they would be cooperative in how they work together economically, and that both states, a Russian nation state and a Ukrainian nation state, would be stronger and more just as states rather than as an autonomous entity within a larger empire. And he sees that treating Ukraine as an equal, in many ways an economic superior, in terms of its agriculture and its education, and usually has been better off than Great Russia has been, that will help not only Ukraine keep what it has rightfully earned, but will assist Russia through beneficial trade with Ukraine. So Tikhomotov really takes the Ukrainian idea in a way that I have taken it. A way, first of all, to understand that the Russian state has simply been wrong in oppressing and repressing the Ukrainian national movement, rather than fostering it and guiding it for their own purposes, as the Austrian government has done. That the Ukrainian nation is real, that they do have their own separate language and separate traditions, which come from the influence of Poland and of Austria. It is far closer to the West than Moscow ever was. And so it's developed a very different cultural and religious outlook, while still being Orthodox, of course. And in political terms, all this means is that if the Russian state were to assist and guide the Ukrainian national movement to create some form of an independent administration in union with St. Petersburg, this would develop far in a far more beneficial way than the current policy of A, repression, and B, economic exploitation. The fact is that Ukraine saw its harvest and its black soil region and its labor and its industry, which was fairly substantial, be extracted from Ukraine and the profits brought to St. Petersburg. This was a terrible error. It was unjust, and it shows the problems of empire to begin with, that empires, especially the Russian one, because its central forested regions were, you know, generally were had very poor soil. And so beneficial trade with better soil, Ukraine chief among them, are absolutely necessary. That a huge proportion of Russian economic growth occurred in Ukraine, a huge proportion of its harvest, especially its sugar in the form of beets and wheat and light industry and textiles, these were overwhelmingly Ukrainian. The whole northwest of Russia is not arable land because it's mostly salt marshes. So Ukraine became the central agrarian productive unit in the empire. Tikhomotov's view is that you should have two nation states as orthodox allies, like Russia and Serbia, rather than this awful exploitation that St. Petersburg has placed upon the Ukrainian people. So anyway, that is the basic political view of Lev Tikhomirov, this kind of moderate nationalist monarchism, and the idea of the legitimate and historically sound connection of the common people, the commune on the one hand, and its relationship with the monarchy on the other. Tikhomirov in many ways reflects my own particular point of view, and it is his work is absolutely essential in understanding the political philosophy of not only Orthodox monarchy in Russia, but also the idea of Christian socialism as it developed in the Russian landscape. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.